On the 29th of November 1994, six-year-old Ricky Neave was found dead in woods near his home. His naked body had been grotesquely posed in a star shape, and his death would shock a community. And the hunt for his killer would see his own mother wrongly prosecuted for his murder. The true killer would not be brought to justice for almost three decades. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So let's get into today's case. Six-year-old Ricky Neave. He was born on the 4th of March, 1988, and he lived with his mum, Ruth Neave. He had two younger sisters, Sheridan and Rochelle. They lived on Welland Estate, Peterborough. He also had an older eight-year-old sister, Rebecca, but Rebecca was in foster care. Ricky's father, Trevor Harvey, he had actually split up with Ruth when Ricky was just three. So there had been a level of dysfunction in his life. And obviously when there are children in the family who were in foster care, we appreciate there will have been a level of chaos that that family had experienced. That's why kids end up in care. Ricky's sisters, they actually, down the line, would later describe him as a really loving, caring, and cheeky boy. Bear in mind, this is a very young child, but despite his incredibly young age, he went out of his way to try to look after his sisters. For example, if there was no food in the house, he would go to the shops and he would steal food for them. He would actually bring it to them. Now, of course, we don't want a child having to shoplift for food, and we don't want a child involved in any criminal behaviour, but this was just crime, as far as I'm concerned. There was a just reason behind his actions. He was prioritising the need of his siblings and making sure that they actually got to eat. So there is definitely an element where Ricky is concerned that he's streetwise beyond his years. And another thing that he'd do for his sisters, which is testament to the kind of little boy he was, because we are talking about a really, really little boy. He's 6 years of age. But as opposed to allowing his sisters to just get on with their lives as he was having to, he acted as a mentor. He'd run them baths. He'd ensure that they were clean. And one of the things that's notable about Ricky is, even though he's this young child, he really enjoyed being clean. It was important to him. Now, the care in his home was not ideal. And at the age of six, he was often left to just wander the streets alone. So we know that that isn't ideal. It's certainly not the safest experience for a child. But lots of kids at a young age go to the park by themselves, play out by themselves. So it's not completely atypical. But again, when we tie that in with what I've just said about the family, it wasn't an ideal experience for him. And on account of his family experience, he was a vulnerable child. And one of the problems with being a vulnerable child is sometimes it can make you really trusting. And I think that Ricky Neave was an individual who was a little bit too trusting and engaged with strangers. And unfortunately, him engaging with strangers would cost him his life. When you think about the case I'm going to cover today, there are so many twists and turns in it that it's breathtaking. So if you haven't heard about this case, you really do need to strap yourself in. For me, it seems as though the deck was stacked against Nicky pretty much from day one. The short life that he had, it was full of misery. It was painful. He grew up in an environment of abuse, an environment of neglect, and the living conditions at home were really, really horrible. The house was filthy, and when Ruth was brought to court later down the line, she'd actually be described in court as a wholly unfit mother. She had apparently, by the way, been in contact with social services because one of the things that she had asked for was respite care for her kids. So even though Ruth is not a great mum, we also have to acknowledge that she's a mum who's aware of her struggles and is essentially seeking support to manage those struggles. She was aware, evidently, that she wasn't coping. And one of the things that she allegedly, and I use the word allegedly specifically here because we don't know whether this is factual, but social services were allegedly told that she would kill Ricky if he wasn't taken into care. Let's also be very clear. People say things that are wholly inappropriate that they absolutely do not mean. But if you want to get a reaction, such as support and help and engagement of services, the more serious you suggest the ramifications of potential behaviour if that support isn't granted, the more likely there will be support put in place. So just because somebody says, if you don't take him off my hands, I'm going to kill him, that isn't actually a threat on the whole. It's more an intention of saying, this is how serious the situation is. Please attend to my needs. So if she did say it, let's be clear that that doesn't mean that there's a direct threat at this point to Ricky's life. Ruth had actually been abandoned as a child herself. So she'd grown up in the system. She'd grown up in care. And we know from so much research that children who grow up in care, whilst it may be better than their home life, they may be in a safer scenario and situation than they were when they were with their family. The point is, it causes fractures. Children know stereotypically how a family is meant to be. If that's failed and then they're placed in care where they don't even have a parent, they're going to recognize that their life is different and they're going to have feelings and needs that are not met. And that's what happens to Ruth. So one of the ways that she tries to fight that feeling of abandonment and loss and of not having a family is that she wants to have a large family. She wants to make sure that she has children, enough of which will be able to look out for one another. However, even though she wants to create this familial unit with bonds, the truth is she's completely incapable of providing a caring and nurturing environment. She has issues with substance abuse. She was also a dealer. She used to deal speed. For those of you who don't know what speed is, because it's a very 1980s and 1990s drug, I'll have you know. Used to call it cheap man's cocaine. So it's an amphetamine, but it's considerably cheaper than cocaine. And it was very, very popular for a period of time. As I know, it's not that popular these days. People could snort it, they could bomb it, and they could even inject it. And it was a big problem, particularly in certain poorer areas of the UK. The Neave family were known to social services, and Ricky was on the at-risk register. So an at-risk register is the child protection register in the UK. And the basis of this is that we place children on it and families of children on it when there are issues in the home that we believe could lead to a child being at significant risk of harm or in need of monitoring. There are different levels to that. And some children are on it for a very short period of time. Some children remain on it for their entire childhoods. It's as simple as that. And Ricky was on that register. One of the reasons that we know that Ruth wasn't the ideal parent, shall we say, is that she actually used Ricky as a drug runner. And also, on occasion, she used him as a punch bag. So there was physical abuse in Ricky's young life. She would often get him to go out so that he could bring her amphetamines. He'd actually been sent out at times after midnight with a note to a drug dealer asking for sherbet, which, as we know, would be slang for speed. I doubt he would be turning up with a dip dab stick. Probably people in other countries don't know what that is either. Again, it's just sherbet with a dip. Now, Ruth denies this. She said that that didn't happen, but I'm just telling you what information I found out and the anecdotal reports of others. And this certainly is something that was commented on. Ricky was also often absent from school, which is terrible when you think about his age. He's six. A child should be attending mainstream education or being homeschooled at this point. But what we do know about him is that he would usually turn up to school at lunchtime. Now, the reason that he did that and his teachers were aware of this is because he could have a proper meal. He was rarely getting fed appropriately at home, and turning up and getting that lunch every single day was a way of getting warm food inside of him, and it was really important. It's why free school meals are so imperative for people who are economically challenged. Ruth would also keep him at home sometimes, and the reason for that is it was the way that he would appear to others. If he was black and blue because he'd been beaten, then clearly she didn't want the eyes of the authorities on him. She'd been known to grab him by the throat. She'd been known to push him up against a wall, even lifting him so high by his throat so that his feet were about a foot off the ground, which is high-level abuse. And on one occasion, Ricky was allegedly left screaming after he'd been locked out of his house in his pyjamas, which is terrifying for a child. I think that lots of us know those feelings where a parent has made us feel scared and it feels like the whole of your world crumbles because your primary caregivers are your support strategy. And when they breach those boundaries and make you feel completely alone, it is absolutely abandoning and terrifying. Ricky News babysitter, she claims to have actually seen Ruth make Ricky stand in a corner before squirting washing up liquid into his mouth. And another time, she allegedly held him upside down off a bridge as he screamed. Now, the foster carer claimed that Ricky once opened the door to her and he actually had idiot scrawled on his forehead. Now, despite all these allegations, and like I said, they're anecdotal, they're what people have suggested happened, we have to look at what is factually noted. And despite all those allegations I've just gone through, a social worker actually stated that while she had definitely seen Ruth scream and shout at her kids, she had never once seen her act violently towards them. But Ricky's sisters, well, they dispute that a little bit. They say that actually their mother treated them terribly. They suggested that she'd sometimes keep them locked naked in their rooms. And they felt that she was far more interested in drugs and men than her own children. If you are a dependent, if you have a drug issue or an alcohol issue or a gambling issue, the children that you have are not your priority. You are sick, you are ill, you have a dependency, and like it or otherwise, you channel your energy into that particular dependency. So it would not be unusual for children to look at a dependent parent and feel completely neglected. Arguably as well, as a parent, even though you have a dependency, it can be very difficult to step into the arena of truth and say, yes, I didn't prioritise my children because I was a dependent. I just want to shout out BetterHelp, who is my sponsor today. I'm a therapist, I spent 20 years working in the field, and the reality is I think that therapy is amazing, and BetterHelp is bringing it into your homes all over the world. BetterHelp online therapy assesses your needs and can match you with your own licensed professional therapist in less than 48 hours. It's not a crisis line, it's not self-help, it's professional therapy done securely online, and it is available to people worldwide. You can log into your account anytime, you can send a message to your therapist, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you don't have to be on camera if you don't want to, and getting therapy every week is as easy as a few clicks away on your laptop or phone. And in therapy, you know it can take a few tries to find the right fit for you, so BetterHelp makes it easy and free to change therapists, you know, if you don't feel that they're the right therapist for you. It's more affordable than traditional online therapy, which is great, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp is an amazing way to invest in yourself. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're actually recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states in the US. And they have a special offer for you guys, my true crime viewers. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/bang. That's 10% off your first month of online therapy at betterhelp.com/bang. So arguably, you can have two people living completely different experiences in the same house with a different truth from one another. But we have to know that Ruth certainly had problems, and all of her children have commented that as far as they were concerned, she was a pretty dreadful mother. Ruth, of course, down the line, denied ever physically abusing her children whatsoever. She said it's categorically untrue, it's been made up. We get to the 28th of November 1994. Now this starts off like any other Monday. Ricky eats his breakfast and he leaves for school around 9:30 a.m. which means of course that he's definitely going to be late for school, isn't he? You know, he should be there before 9. But this day he never even arrives there. And actually, it's the last time that his mother ever sees him alive. Because later that day, we find that Ricky's mother, Ruth, is starting to get really concerned. Because Ricky's usually home by around 3:45 p.m, but there's absolutely no sign of him. Ruth then reports him missing at 6 p.m, and she explains to the call handler who takes the call that she hasn't seen her son since he left for school. She's concerned because he hasn't arrived home at his usual time. She's able to describe to the call handler what he's wearing, his school uniform, a little blue coat, and the handler says, well, could you have gone to a friend's house? But his mother explains he's never done anything like that before. So the police arrive at her home on Red Mile Walk at 6:17 p.m.
Go ahead, call the police.
My son hasn't come back from school yet.
Pardon?
I said I'm reporting my son missing. He hasn't been back from school.
Right.
Well, I haven't seen him since this morning.
Okay, what's your name, please?
Mrs. Ruth, I'm Nate.
Now, I'm not going to try to defend Ruth as a mother. I cannot tell you whether the reports of her being abusive are true or otherwise, but what I can say is, the minute that her son does not return home, she's concerned. The actions that she's taking in a very short amount of time suggest that while she's considered neglectful on one level, certainly on an emotional level, there is a connection there. Why is she so worried immediately that her child has broken a habit? And why has she got in touch with the police literally hours after him going missing? As a neglectful parent who lets a child just wander the streets constantly, why would she be worried about this child not being home if it was just commonplace for him? So I'm just bringing that in because she responds very, very quickly to the fact that he's not around. We get to the 29th of November, 1994, still no sign of Ricky. Police are obviously desperately concerned and they're searching all the locality. And at this point, they've actually managed to speak to more than one resident who's claimed to see Ricky early in the evening the previous day. So now at 12:05 p.m, the police are searching an area of woodland. This is near the Welland Estate, and they make the worst discovery ever. It's horrific, it's so grim. They find 6-year-old Ricky Neve's body. It's among the trees. It's near a children's den. It's literally a 5-minute walk from his home. And finding the body of a child is going to be one of those moments that defines a police officer's career. It's going to be unforgettable. It stains the consciousness. It brings all your fears into focus. And for the officers finding Ricky's body, it would be blindsiding and painful. But it's not just that they find his body. It's the fact that Ricky's body has been left posed in a star shape. He's lying on his back, his arms are outstretched and his legs are wide apart. And one of the things that they noted was the way that he'd been positioned was perfectly symmetrical. Even his thumbs were in the same position. And that means that the killer had felt confident enough to take their time. They weren't worried about being discovered. And that's scary because this individual had enjoyed what they'd done. It also appeared when they looked at the body that he'd been freshly bathed. They noticed straight away that there was hemorrhaging to his eyes and his face. And they saw these quite clear marks on his neck, and it was in a repetitive linear pattern. And even the first observers thought that the reason for that was probably because it could have been caused by the zip. Actually, the post-mortem later established that he had been strangled with the collar of his anorak. It had just been pulled back really hard against his throat from behind. But this is how they discovered that gorgeous little boy. And like I said, for those first responders who found him, it was a defining moment in their careers. So now the worst has happened and we know that Ricky Neve is dead. The police now are going to scour the area because they're going to look for any other incriminating evidence. They're going to try to find any leads. And we get to the 30th of November 1994. It's 9:30 a.m. in the morning. And the police managed to find Ricky's clothes. They've been put in a wheelie bin in Willoughby Court. That's just yards from the wood where his body's been left. The clothes that had been left there included his school trousers, his blue jacket, his white shirt, and his underwear. And It feels like, judging from the condition of the clothes, it's very likely they've been put in the bin shortly after Ricky was killed. They were fairly dry, they were fairly clean. And in his pockets, they found children's cards and toys. And for me, that's really poignant. When my little boys were tiny, they always had pockets full of whatever they were collecting and things that they'd changed with their friends at school. And it just reminds you of the naivety and innocence and beauty and presence of childhood. Just knowing that he was carrying the stuff a little boy would typically have in his pockets is so heartbreaking. But they can tell that the clothes were obviously removed and then placed in that bin pretty quickly. So of course, they're now dealing with the worst kind of murder in the world, which is a child murder. So they immediately launch the inquiry, and both Ricky's father and Ruth, they make emotional appeals on TV for any information that is going to bring the capture of their son's killer to justice. But there was a problem, because when you go on television, and we see this per se, even when police hold actual press conferences and an individual is pleading for the return of a child or a family member, part of it is absolutely to get the information out there. You want eyes on the case. You want people to remember that tiny piece of information that they may have thought was useless or irrelevant. And actually, it fits into the puzzle perfectly, and it creates an opportunity for a killer to be caught. So it's really imperative that these press conferences occur, or that people go on television and have interviews, like Ian Huntley, a video I did on the Soham murders. It was absolutely the interview on television that made police home in on the fact that this guy is strange and we believe that he is now a suspect. Before that, they thought he was a nice guy. So the television appearances can cause immense breakthroughs, but it can also bring bias. We have an expectation of what a grieving parent will look like and sound like. And if you don't fit that paradigm, you may have a big problem, because it can make people believe that you are guilty, even when you're not. And then people can start to, shall we say, introduce information that may have a bias associated with it that may be very problematic for you, if people decide to home in on you being the subject who's a suspect. So Ruth's appearance has dire consequences for her. First of all, locals had already been, at this point, speaking to the police. They'd said she wasn't known for being a good mum. She treated him very badly. So they're already getting prepped with these ideas about the pen portrait, a possibility of who she is as a mother. And it's really challenging for her, because some of the people who were actually having these conversations to the police, they were people that Ruth considered friends. So she isn't just losing her child at this point. She's now hearing that people that she felt she trusted and had loyalty with are betraying her. And it makes her angry. And the problem with that is that in the TV interview, wow, that comes across. So she looks defensive. She's obviously hurt. But the way that she speaks and acts, it doesn't seem contextual for somebody who's just lost their child in the most heinous, disastrous, devastating of ways. So as soon as she's appeared on television, the police are contacted. The floodgates open, essentially. Lots of people get in contact saying she's a terrible mother. There was literally not a shred, and I mean not a shred, of sympathy for her at all. As far as people were concerned and the police, she was acting. So now we have the police suspecting that Ruth may indeed have killed her own son. And what is tragic about this case, and my God, it is tragic, is because they had that belief and bias, it was the line of inquiry that dominated the investigation. Now, in policing, that is the last thing you need. The whole premise of the word leads is the idea that you can take evidence, information, inquiry, and you can look at the different threads. So every path leads potentially to a different outcome. If you close other leads down and you follow only one, then you better believe that a case can be built around it. And the problem there is you're shutting down the possibilities of other outcomes. And when you do that, you may well be negating a line of inquiry that isn't just essential, but that will actually give you the real result that's required. But that doesn't happen. Because this bias and belief that they have the woman that they're looking for, it means the police overlook vital evidence that was right in front of them. And I'm going to talk about that today, but believe me, this was not difficult for the police to look at and see. It was there in front of their eyes, but they chose not to see it. And that meant that a murderer remained at large for decades, walking our streets, having access to our kids, having the potential to do great harm. All because the police decided to build a case around a yes, imperfect, yes, not necessarily the peaches and cream parent that those kids deserved. But that doesn't mean that Ruth was a murderer, and certainly shouldn't have meant that they decided to put all of the eggs in that basket when it came down to deciding on her guilt. So the police now have got Ruth as a suspect in their minds, and they go and search her home. And guess what they find? Well, they find lots of books. I know, who knew that lots of books might be an issue? But let me tell you, they're not all just your average books. No, many of them were about black magic and the occult. Not being weird, guys, go in my cupboard. You're going to find quite a lot of those as well. Probably in between all my serial killer books and my true crime books and my psychology of serial killers books, because I've got them all. I've got white witch books, spell books, incantation books. I'm interested in that stuff. But apparently, if I get searched by the police, that's going to cause alarm bells that I'm some kind of crazy Satanist. Literally, just going to say it, guys. Apparently, this stuff is not acceptable when it comes down to cases being investigated by the police. And another book that they found had a picture of Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. A lot of you will know that picture, the Vitruvian Man. And the police decide, well, the fact that Ricky was positioned in a star shape reflects this particular picture. Grasping at straws does not seem appropriate enough and strong enough to demonstrate how ridiculous that assumption would be. Also, they discovered that Ruth was writing about a serial killer, like a lot of writers do. That's why true crime is one of the biggest sellers in the world, and true crime fiction is also one of the biggest sellers in the world, because writers write about serial killers. And in it, she described it as a first-person account of the perfect murder about a fellow who strangles and mutilates a girl. And that is case closed for the police. Few books of the occult, picture of a man in a star shape, and also a written account of somebody starting a book on a serial killer. Genuinely, go with me on this, because that pretty much is their evidence. So the investigators conclude that Ruth had killed Ricky in some kind of black magic ritual. This is correct. Black magic ritual. And they decided that she wanted rid of him because he interfered in the relationship that she had with her husband, Dean Neve. Apparently he didn't get on very well with Ricky, and she then decided because of this, she was gonna kill him at home, and then she was gonna wheel his body in a buggy, dump it in the woods that night after reporting him missing. They said that's why people had actually seen Ricky alive earlier that evening, and the fact that she then positioned him in a star shape posing of his body, that had all been part of a ritualistic sacrifice. They put together that story. Now, I will tell you, in the 90s, there was a thing called Satanic Panic, where it appeared that the whole world decided that everybody was involved in some kind of occult crime. Anybody who was caught with books or with a particular predilection and interest in an area that was not considered appropriate were deemed as potentially being Satanist. And don't get me wrong, we know there are Satanists out there. Let me draw your attention to Richard Ramirez, who was a Satanist until he died. And certainly there have been paedophile networks that have a dark arts belief system. They all need to be put on an island, towed away, and left to rot. But this still isn't common. It's as simple as that. But at the time, satanic panic was kind of spreading like wildfire, and it feels like in this case, the police most definitely hooked onto it. So Ruth is now getting arrested on the 19th of January 1995. They suspect that she's the person who's killed him. She's brought in for questioning, at which point she denies ever harming her son. Bear in mind, we're talking the flimsiest of circumstantial evidence, and yet on the 24th of May 1995, in spite of denying and protesting that she is involved in her son's death, she gets charged officially with Ricky's murder. So at this point, she gets charged with murder and also with cruelty offences in relation to Ricky and his two sisters. Now, she pleads immediately not guilty to the murder charge, but what she does do is she pleads guilty to the child cruelty offences. Now, she said the reason that she pled guilty to the child cruelty offences is because she'd been bullied by the police. And she said that when she admitted to that particular charge, she had no idea what she was actually admitting to. As far as she was concerned, the admission was simply about occasionally slapping her kids now and then. She didn't realise that it was quite a grievous claim to admit to. And so even though she did say that she was guilty of that, she didn't believe that it was going to have any large charge or sentence associated with it. We then get to October 1996. Now, this is like 2 years after Ricky's death. And Ruth Neve's murder trial happens at Northampton Crown Court. And the prosecution, of course, allege at this point that she killed Ricky at home. They said that she'd grabbed his anorak, lifted him and twisted the cloth for at least 30 seconds until he went limp. And they said that this was similar to how she'd allegedly punished him in the past. They then said that she'd wheeled his body in a buggy to the woods after reporting him missing. So this is how they present their case. And bear in mind, there's been a hell of a lot of bias towards this woman already in the press. There's this 16-day trial. But in spite of the police doing their absolute best, she was unanimously acquitted of murder. And when she was acquitted of that murder, she apparently collapsed in tears in the dock when the verdict was read out. She was, I imagine, convinced that in spite of the circumstantial and ridiculous evidence that was brought forward, that people would turn on her. Her friends had turned on her. So I imagine that it wouldn't have been too much of a mental stretch to guess that the jury would also be blindsided by the evidence, see her as a child murderer and convict her. But even though she was found not guilty of that, she was sentenced to 7 years in prison for child cruelty. 7 years. Now, I am the first person who believes that you need to go down for child cruelty genuinely, but I do feel that that 7 years was a relatively harsh punishment for this woman, bearing in mind that I don't think she even knew what she was admitting to when she said that she was guilty of child cruelty. So this is a big sentence for her. You know, we see people who have killed individuals and they have been responsible for the killing and manslaughter and they've got sentences of that length. So arguably, this is going to be a massive issue for her to suddenly confront the fact that she's going to prison. And of course, what else does it mean? It means that her two other daughters are going to be placed into care. And that meant that she never had contact with her children ever again. And when you look at where Ruth was incarcerated, she was incarcerated at the same prison as Myra Hindley and Rose West. I mean, if you want the worst company in the world, welcome to that prison. I mean, imagine sitting there and be like, who's my neighbour? Oh, it's Rose West. Okay, is there anything worse that could happen than that? Yeah, yeah, on the other side, it's Myra Hindley. Ugh. And she actually stated that Hindley once came over and saw her, entered a cell and said, "You're not a murderer." And to be fair, Ruth took that as a bizarre compliment. But I get it. I get the fact that for Ruth, she's actually talking to the most notorious child killer who we're all very thrilled died in prison and never saw the light of day again, Myra Hindley. But the fact that she can sniff out the fact that Ruth isn't capable of that, I appreciate that what she was saying was, it was nice that somebody who certainly was a child killer didn't see a reflection of themselves in me. Now, Ruth gets released in the year 2000. And of course, she starts trying to rebuild her life, but it's difficult. And I'll tell you, she's had a lot of big challenges in her life, because in 1999, her husband Dean, he'd actually been killed in a car crash. So she's dealing with a whole new world. She's no access to her children. Her husband's dead. And people believe that she's a child killer, because that whole belief system that there is no smoke without fire. Look, we all think that most of the time. It takes somebody with an inordinate amount of compassion to be able to see past those things, particularly in mind with the fact that she had served quite a hefty sentence for something that's considered heinous, which is child cruelty. But in spite of the fact she's trying to rebuild her life, there's this massive question that remains. If Ruth Neve didn't kill Ricky, then who did? So the police continue to search for Ricky's killer, but with no new leads, bearing in mind they hadn't really done any of the leads initially, to the point where all those leads had proven useless because they dried up and disappeared because they didn't actually follow any of them, the case goes cold. And because that case has now gone cold, the finger of suspicion is always fixed on Ruth. You know, she'd been vilified, and the not guilty murder verdict actually hadn't made any difference to the majority of people's opinion. Now, even though Ruth had had these pretty difficult, challenging losses and incarceration and experiences and loss, she does ultimately find happiness after meeting a guy called Gary Rogers, and she later marries Gary. And together, they start looking into the prosecution files, and they themselves start to find potential leads that have been missed in 1994. Now, remember, as much as Ruth may not have been the greatest parent, and I'm sure that she also wants to exonerate her guilt and make people see that she was an innocent party, I also feel that she could have just disappeared. She could have just got on with her life, moved to a different area, allowed her and a new partner to sail off into the sunset silently away from all of this noise around Ricky Neve's death. She doesn't do that. She's like a dog with a bone. She may not have been a great mum when Ricky was alive, but my God, I think that after losing her children, after this time in prison, she's realised that she wants justice for her child. It's not just about clearing her name. So finding these leads that have been missed in 1994 are really important. And they're joined essentially by the editor of the Cambridge Times, John Elworthy. And they get together and they start campaigning for the case to be reopened. And in the end, they're able to present the findings to the police. So they work really hard on this. We get to 2015 and a cold case review is launched into Ricky's unsolved murder. And this means they have a crack new team of investigators re-examining the case. Now, one of the things they are immediately drawn to, which is evidence that was there at the very beginning of this, is that the post-mortem indicated that Ricky's last meal had been Weetabix for breakfast, and it had only been partially digested. And that meant that Ricky had been killed within 2 hours after eating his breakfast around 9:30 a.m. Instantly cast doubt on those original theories that had been killed much later in the day. And that also suggested, therefore, that Ruth hadn't killed him later on in the day and wheeled him into the woods at night. It doesn't corroborate that story. Also, the evidence showed that Ricky's shoes had been covered in mud from the woods when they were found in the bin. And that means that he hadn't been wheeled into the woods, had he? He'd have had to have walked in there, but just not returned, essentially. So again, that breaks down that story that the police created. Also, another startling piece of evidence that was just overlooked at the time of the investigation was that several sex attacks had taken place on Ricky's estate in the 2 years before his death. Shockingly, the offences had been committed by children on children. But the police ignored the pile of evidence. As far as they were concerned, they had zoned in on Ruth, decided that she was guilty, and built the case around that. Simple as. They'd selected to pursue the evidence that had supported their theory, as opposed to the evidence that could have brought the real killer to justice. Now, since the killing of Ricky Neave, and the point where this new crack team of investigators are appointed, there's been major breakthroughs because of DNA evidence. Now, at the time of the killing in 1994, DNA profiling had been in its absolute infancy, but there had been major developments in this area of science. And just to put it into context, it used to be that you could test DNA against like 14 different lines. Now you're talking about a million different features. It's incomparable. So this is a huge leaps that have been made. So they really hope that a forensic review of the evidence might be able to shed more light on the case. And this meant that they needed to go back, look at the evidence that was found at the time of the murder and see whether there was any forensic examples that could be used. They found sticking tape, the sticking tape that had been used to take samples from Ricky's clothing. And that sticking tape they sent for forensic analysis. And now it's a waiting game because it can take a really long time for that analysis to take place. But February 2016, after all those years, a DNA profile was successfully extracted from the tape. It was run through the National DNA Database, which is a database that, particularly if you've been involved in a crime, you will likely have given a sample of DNA, means that if you have prior and you show up on the system, it's an easy match for the police. It occurs. After 22 years, a match comes up, and that individual was identified as 36-year-old James Watson. James Watson was born on the 1st of April 1981. He had been just 13 years of age at the time that Ricky was killed. Also, they were able to note that his father lived on the same estate as Ricky. Now, after Watson's parents had split up, that was in September 1990, he'd stayed with his father. And Watson himself was an individual that certainly had some deeply problematic behaviours associated with him. He had a string of previous convictions, and I'll go through some of his convictions because you will hear just how damning his personality clearly was from a very early age. He was a convicted arsonist. He'd actually firebombed a British Transport police building. That caused nearly £1 million of damage. He actually got sentenced to 6 years for this crime. It disturbs me that an individual would feel confident enough as a criminal to be like, I want to be an arsonist. Where should I arson? Should I arson somewhere that will be difficult to discover who I am? Should I arson a home of somebody I don't like? Should I arson, I don't know, some fields just to see how wildfire spreads? No, what I'll do is I'll arson a British Transport police building by firebombing it. 6 years does not sound like a long time to me. It really doesn't. Also, he had sexually assaulted a man in 2018, so he certainly had form as a malicious predator. He'd also been convicted of possession of cannabis, handling stolen goods, carrying a firearm in a public place, taking a motor vehicle without consent. He also had 17 theft and 11 burglary convictions. But if you could get even more concerning and disturbing, after I've just given you a list that included firebombing a police transport building, it does. It gets even more disturbing. Turns out he had this really morbid fantasy and sexual interest in small children. And allegedly, He'd indecently touched a 5-year-old child just a year before Ricky's murder. He'd also encouraged the child to touch him and told him not to tell anyone. The child was actually a friend of Ricky's. Now, fortunately, that child had told his mother, and the mother had reported it to the police, but the police had not taken any further action. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Blows my mind every single time I say this. Going to the police station, my son's just been sexually molested by a teenager who's told him to just say nothing and keep it a secret. Okay. What do you want us to do? I think I would like you to go and arrest the child and either have him placed in a secure unit where he can be dealt with therapeutically or at least be monitored in the community so that he isn't acting this way with other children and escalating his behaviour. Something like that. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. We're not going to do it though. Sorry. Too busy fitting cases up with other people by just pressing charges against them that they actually aren't guilty of. Takes a lot of time doing that. Anyway, it didn't have any further action associated with it. Watson was also suspected to have masturbated over images of young children in underwear. Yes, that whole heap of weird, allegedly kept clothing catalogues and magazines in his care home room. Because back in the day, before internet shopping, you'd get your Grattan catalogue or your Mothercare catalogue and you could order underwear for your kids on there, totally innocent, nothing weird and perverted about it, just shopping. But this guy was using it as a sexual aid. Why is somebody not running into this care home right now and removing this child to a secure therapeutic environment? Because there is something really weird and wrong about this. Also, an ex-girlfriend of his claimed that during sex he would throttle her. So the paraphilia level here is deeply disturbing and certainly should have been dealt with. Because on top of that, it's alleged that as a child he'd killed a bird and laid it out. Spread eagle. We're in Jeff Nudama territory right now, aren't we? We're in the Milwaukee Cannibal territory. But nonetheless, people were just letting him get on with this. Oh, it's just hijinks. It's just killing a bird and spreading an eagle. Who doesn't do that on a Wednesday evening? 99.999% of the whole world. Anyway, if that isn't bad enough, the manager of the care home that he was at also confirmed that they found dismembered carcass of a pheasant in his room. I do not know how anybody can look back at this case and say failures were not abundant. He later gets described, by the way, by an investigator as a manipulator and a fantasist. I'm going to be really honest with you. If I'm going to think about titles of how I would describe this human being, manipulator and a fantasist is low on my list. I have arsonist, sexual predator, child pervert, and general horrible human criminal. Those would be higher on my list than manipulator and a fantasist, just throwing it out there. Now we get to the 22nd of November, 1994. This is almost a week before Ricky's murder, so taking you back in time to how this plays out. James Watson is 13 at this time and is moved from foster care to Woodgate's Children's Home in Cambridgeshire. This is 20 miles away from where Ricky's home is in Peterborough. Now, Watson had actually been removed from his father's care the previous year because he had been suffering some really horrible physical abuse. And his dad was, would you believe it, a serving police officer with Cambridgeshire Police. And he actually gets arrested and he gets jail time for it. So we're talking high level physical abuse, and that's traumatic. And what we know about many violent offenders is that they have experienced serious trauma in their life, and certainly Watson has. Now, Watson couldn't stay with his mother at the time because she was living with somebody that was seen as inappropriate to be around children. So she was making great choices in her partners. And again, that means that Watson must have faced a huge level of abandonment per se. It's a horrible situation where your mother chooses a man over you and your father is such a violent thug that he goes to prison for beating you up. So he's a troubled boy. He's a persistent truant. He really hated school. He had no friends at all. So again, there is a level of alienation there and isolation. We get to the 25th of November 1994. So this is just 3 days before Rick is killed. Watson phones his mother. This is going to be one where you're all, sorry, repeat this, Emma. What did you just say? But just go with me. So Watson phones his mum and is like, Mum, just calling you about a two-year-old boy. Yeah, has a two-year-old boy's body been found? I've heard that he's been abducted from the Paston area of Peterborough and that he's apparently been strangled and he's also been left naked just off the Paston Parkway. Yeah, that's what I'm hearing, Mum. I'm hearing that this little two-year-old has been taken, strangled, and left just off the Paston Parkway naked near a dike. That was just made up. Yeah. He called his mum and had that conversation, and it was just BS. Now that is really strange behaviour, and also think about this, how concerning is it that Ricky's body was found just off the Paston Parkway near a dike? He was naked and he'd been strangled. So investigators believe that Watson had been fantasising for some time about killing a child, and then he had worked on that fantasy and it hadn't been enough and he had made it a reality. It turns out on the morning that Ricky was murdered, several residents actually saw him playing with an older boy when they both, of course, should have been in school. That boy was 13-year-old Watson. Now, as part of the investigation, Watson had actually been interviewed by the police on the 5th of December 1994. But they basically ruled him out really quickly as a suspect. So he had told police he had seen Ricky, and he'd seen Ricky watching a digger on the day that he was killed. He said that there'd been landscaping work taking place on the estate. So Watson had gone over, briefly spoken to Ricky, but he said there was absolutely no physical contact between them. He then told the police that he'd subsequently gone to school after seeing Ricky. However, this had been a lie. Because of course the police are going to automatically go and look back at this point at those records that he claimed he was in school around, but he wasn't. It showed that he hadn't been in school at all that day. And this also means that they didn't check out the alibi that he gave them back at the time, which is just shocking to me. So it also transpired that following Ricky's murder, Watson had become pretty obsessed with the case. He'd been found making multiple photocopies of the local newspaper report at school. So we know that killers often like to forensically follow the case that's playing out. They want to be a part of it. It excites them. It continues the fantasy. It gives them an opportunity to relive the event again and again and again. And this should have been very concerning behaviour for the adults who saw him doing this. Now, due to Watson's young age, and also the fact that police were just fixated on Ricky's mother. You've done it. We don't like the look of you. You've got that picture of that guy, Spread Eagle, and you got those books on the occult. You're definitely guilty, even though there's literally no evidence that's actually linking you forensically or in any way to the crime. Your friends don't like you. They've betrayed you. You definitely need to go down for life. That was going on. So because of this, Watson gets ruled out as any kind of suspect. But now, of course, we've got 2 decades later, he's now designated as a suspect. So he gets arrested on the 19th of April 2016 and they bring him in for an interview. And bear in mind what I told you about the fact that back in the day, 1994, he had been absolutely adamant that there had been no physical contact with Ricky on the day he died whatsoever. But of course, DNA has improved. Forensics are very, very thorough these days. And so the police say, well, okay, you say you had absolutely no contact with this child. How come your DNA was on Ricky's clothing? And in a heartbeat, Watson changes his story. Now he says, oh, hang on. Okay, I may have thought I didn't have contact with Ricky, but on reflection, maybe I picked him up under the armpits to look at diggers through a hole in a fence. Now, the police are like, okay, well, that sounds quite reasonable. Let's just investigate this, because that's what they're going to do. Remember, we're at a different time and space. We know that Ricky's mother did not kill him. We know that the killer is still on the loose. There is a new crack team of investigators that are using forensic DNA evidence to pinpoint the potential of the killer. They're going to go back and check about the hole in the fence and the diggers that could be looked through. And they're able to find archive film footage. And that footage proved that there was no fence back in 1994 at the location that Watson had suggested. The police ultimately at this point are like, this guy has lied enough. And they felt they had sufficient evidence against Watson to charge him with Ricky's murder. So on the 20th of April, 2016, we get Watson released on police bail, but the conditions state that he has to reside at an address in Northampton with an 11 p.m. curfew. What could possibly go wrong? What could possibly go wrong with a criminal who has a list of serious crimes the length of my entire body and is now suspected of murdering a child? I'm sure he's the kind of human being that will just go back into the community, quietly await the trial date, and just accept his fate. Of course, that doesn't happen. 27th of June, 2016, Watson breaches his bail conditions, fails to return to the approved premises by 11 p.m. So the police clearly at that point revoke the license and he's recalled to prison. That meant that he could be arrested on site. But we have a problem, because Watson knows that, and Watson has chosen not to be available under his license conditions because he's left the country. Just like any innocent human being does. It's the first thing that I would do if I was innocent and awaiting trial. I'd be like, how can I make myself look really innocent? Well, I could just like stay and behave myself and get heard in court and prove my innocence. Or I could just like leave the country. No one's gonna think that's weird. But that's what he does. Later down the line, even though he's left the country, he then contacts his probation officer and he claims that he basically left the country in a camper van with an acquaintance who was going to Thailand. Thailand. I mean, it's a beautiful country. It's great for Thai boxing, for example. The fruit's amazing and I like the culture in lots of ways. But it also has, shall we say, a less than perfect score where child sex offences take place. Throwing it out there, somebody who's murdered and potentially abused a child and certainly has a predilection for children going to Thailand does not inspire me with confidence around why he wants to go there. Anyway, he says that he just plans to spend a few days in Europe, but things had gone wrong. And now, while speaking to his probation officer, he's like, it just hasn't worked out. I'm now homeless. And I'm living on the streets in Portugal. And at this point, he says that he needs to get back to the UK. So the probation officer then contacts the police. They contact the British authorities in Portugal. And on the 29th of July 2016, a European arrest warrant was issued. And the police requested Watson's extradition for breaching the terms of his license. A bit of me is like, maybe you should have left him homeless for a little bit longer, just to make him suffer at the end of the day. Just feel a little bit unfair that you can just call the probation officer, get them to get the embassy and get yourself a free flight home. But that's how it works. And clearly we want a potential child murderer under our close watch. So on the 2nd of August 2016, Watson is arrested at the consulate building in Lisbon. And on the 12th of August 2016, he's extradited back to the UK. However, again, I may sound a little bit on the sarcastic side now, guys. It's unlike me. You know me. I'm very serious. I'm rarely sarcastic. The CPS reviews the file and ultimately concludes there was insufficient evidence to prosecute Watson. I know. The guy who's fled the country, literally, to escape prosecution What's guilty about that? The CPS are like, oh, I mean, that sounds like a bit dodgy, but at the end of the day, we've all done it, haven't we? We've all done it. We've all left the country when we're due to be in court for the potential murder of a child. But they're like, yeah, he's just not got enough evidence. Now, the investigation, that could have hit another brick wall were it not for Ricky's own mother launching a victim's right to review the decision not to prosecute. She did this in 2018. Now, I've looked at this scheme and it was launched in 2013. And what it states is that any victim is entitled to seek a review of a decision not to prosecute. So in this context, a victim is defined as a person who has suffered harm, including physical, mental, or emotional harm or economic loss, which was directly caused by criminal conduct. And this includes parents or guardians where the victim is a child or youth under 18. So she has a right to ask for that. We get to October 2019. Now, following that review, the original decision is overturned and it's decided that Watson should be prosecuted. But my heart beats fast thinking about how, if that 2013 guidance had not been issued, this man would never have even been tried for this case. We get to the 20th of February 2020. This is 26 years nearly after Ricky's death. Watson is finally charged with murder. Now, despite having requested, by the way, assistance to return to the UK, he actually tries to get this loophole to challenge the legality of his extradition process. So can you get your head around that? You know, so what do you want to do, Watson? Well, I don't feel that I should have been extradited from Portugal. Didn't you, like, literally call your probation officer and ask them to extradite you? I may have said I was homeless on the streets and wanted to get back to the UK. I didn't mention anything about wanting to actually get arrested, but there was an arrest warrant out for you. I know that, but I'm just saying, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think it was legal. I mean, we can try. Great, I'm sure it'll be fine. Maybe get the CPS officer, who wasn't going to try me at all, to look at this case for me. They seem to be on the correct page when it comes down to the kind of sentencing that I would wish to experience, or not, as it may be. By the way, please don't get Ricky Neve's mother to look at it, because she seems like a dog with a bone regarding her child being murdered. It drives me mad that there are loopholes like this where people like him can literally challenge the legality of his extradition process that he asked for. So we get to February 2022 and the trial commences at the Old Bailey. The prosecution alleges that a teenage Watson had lured 6-year-old Ricky into the woods. They said he had then strangled him from behind using his anorak collar as a ligature. They said he'd murdered Ricky before midday on the 28th of November 1994, and then he'd stripped Ricky and he had posed him in a star shape. Now, although there wasn't evidence of an actual sexual assault, what the prosecution alleged was that the crime had been sexually motivated. The defence, of course, they say that's just incorrect, because some witnesses had said that they had seen Ricky on the evening of the 28th. The defence argued it was Ruth Neve who had murdered her son. But the prosecution argued that this had just been false ghost sightings, that people thought they'd seen Ricky, but it was evident it wasn't him. And meanwhile, witnesses who could vouch for Ruth's whereabouts meant that she could not have killed Ricky. So people actually could testify in court that they had seen where she was, and it was not possible that she could have been at the scene of the crime when the crime was committed. We get to the 21st of April 2022. The trial lasts nearly 4 months. And after the trial ends, the jury go and they deliberate, and it takes more than 36 hours of deliberation. The jury find Watson guilty of Ricky's murder by a majority verdict of 10-2. So that means that two people didn't necessarily believe that there was enough evidence to convict him, but that the others believed beyond reasonable doubt that he was Ricky Neve's killer. Now, the murder of any child is absolutely shocking. However, for me, the shock value in this case almost seems to have been muted due to the passage of time. And the fact that his killer is now in his 40s. Because if you think about this, had Watson been convicted at the time he committed the offence, it would undoubtedly have been considered an even more notorious killing than it already is. Because bear in mind that Ricky Neave was killed by a 13-year-old, and that 13-year-old killed him just 18 months after James Bulger was brutally murdered by two 10-year-olds. Also, I'm going to be honest, we have to have some sympathy with Ricky's mother, Ruth, because she would never have won Mum of the Year award. We all know that. Quite the opposite. You know, her daughters still refuse to have any contact with her. They partially blame her for their brother's death because they feel that she abused him and neglected him. But Ruth's case is a perfect case of trial by media. You know, the police and the public, they made their minds up about her guilt from the get-go. And it is horrific to think that her son had been murdered, yet she received zero sympathy. In fact, if anything, she was just subjected to hostility and abuse and convicted of a crime against her child and jailed with genuine child killers. That's a terrible sentence to endure. Tragically as well, Ricky's father, Trevor, died 9 years ago. So he never got to see this man brought to justice for the murder of his child. And his family stated that the pain of losing Ricky never left him. If Ricky had been alive today, he'd be 33. He could potentially have been married with children of his own. And we know how protective he was of his sisters, how he kept them clean, how he kept them fed. He would likely have been a good parent. It seems so unfair that he was robbed of this opportunity, whilst, with respect, his killer has spent almost 3 decades just living the best of his life at liberty. And there are some other things that are really grating about this case, because Watson was only 13 when he committed the murder. And because of that, guys, he had to be sentenced as a child. And that meant that he was sentenced to life, but with a minimum term of only 15 years. And that means he could be released when he is 56. If he had committed that crime as an adult, he'd have been locked up for much longer. In fact, he'd have been locked up for somewhere around 30 years. I personally don't think that he should have been tried as a child. He had evaded capture for a long period of time. He had committed lots of other crimes. He was an individual who had walked our streets with all of this potential, had never taken responsibility, accountability, and culpability for his crimes. Why then should he deserve to be tried as a child? But that's the law. Now, of course, because this man has been brought to light, police are now currently investigating whether he could have committed more murders since Ricky's killing in 1994, which is absolutely horrifying. Because if that's the case, not only would the police be responsible for fitting up a woman who is innocent, for building a biased case around one line of inquiry that led ultimately to other leads being dismissed, it would also mean that those actions led to the unnecessary deaths of other children. Only time will tell whether that's true, but it's hard to imagine that a leopard would ever change their spots. And what we know from his criminal history is he was offending all the way through to his capture. So it doesn't bode well. I hope that you feel I've done this case justice. It's been a challenging one. There has been frustrations within it. And at the end of the day, I don't really feel that Ricky got the justice that he deserved. 15 years does not sound like a very long time for anybody who has maliciously, callously, and murderously killed a child. I also want to make it clear that I'm not defending Ricky Neave's mother from the way that she was as a parent early on, but I do want to acknowledge that she had a very challenging life, and certainly the way that she has treated this case since she left prison, the way that she diligently fought for justice for her child, does suggest that she has recognised that her parenting was not necessarily paramount as it should have been back in the day, and she's tried to make up for it. And hopefully one day she will get to see her son again and he will recognise that she really did try to be the mother that he deserved in the end. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.